The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
This morning I'm going to share a koan which appears in a couple of different places. One of them is in the Book of Equanimity, or the Book of Serenity, the Shoyo Roku, which we've referred to a couple of times so far during this sesshin. And this collection was originally a set of 100 koans with verses by our friend Hongzhir, who we have a lot of texts from in our sutra book. His student, Wansong, took that collection and added introductions and commentaries, and that's the version of the Book of Serenity or the Book of Equanimity that we use in our current day. It had a lot of different history, getting lost, getting destroyed, being refound, like so many texts in Zen. And I kind of like that. It's had such a checkered history. It seems like these books come to us and everything is all set. But really, over the hundreds of years that it took to kind of get this text down, many things may have changed. And one of the things about the Book of Serenity that I also both like and find perplexing is that it refers quite a bit to current Chinese culture, that is the culture of the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries when it was compiled and revised and dispersed among Zen students. So there are a couple of things as I read this koan that might not make any sense to you whatsoever. Of course, even if I explain it, it might not make any sense, so I'm going to explain it anyway, but don't worry if it just completely goes past you. So Wansong, as I said, wrote introductions, and I'm going to read his introduction and also the case itself and then the poem by Hongzhir. Actually, Wansong also wrote a poem, so I think I'll read that too. So Wansong's introduction. Playing with reflections, struggling for the form, you don't recognize that the form is the source of the reflection. Raising your voice to stop an echo, you don't know the voice is the root of the echo. If it's not riding an ox looking for an ox, then it's using a wedge to remove a wedge. How can you avoid these extremes? And the case. Venerable Yan Yang asked Zhao Zhou, when not a single thing is brought, then what? Zhao Zhou said, put it down. Yan Yang said, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? Zhao Zhou said, then carry it out. And here's the poem by Wansong. Not bringing a single thing, both shoulders can't bear it up. At the words, he suddenly knows his error. In his heart is boundless joy, since from poisonous ill, he forgot what was on his mind. Snakes and tigers have been his intimates, empty and still for 1,000 years. The pure breeze still hasn't stopped. And Hongzhir's verse, not prepared for meticulous action, he loses to the first to move. Realizing himself the coarseness of his mind, he's embarrassed at bumping his head. When the game is ended, the axe handles rotted at his side. Clean and purify the ordinary bones to play with the immortals. So lots of stuff in here. I'm not going to have time to look into everything, but as I was contemplating this koan, a bunch of things leapt out at me. One, of course, is the koan itself, and then a few lines from from both of the verses by Wansong and his teacher Hongzhi. And the koan itself, to me, is one of the simplest and most straightforward statements about the traps we get into. This is a koan once again about Zhaozhou who gave us Mu, Zhaozhou who gave us so many different koans. David's beautiful talk last night about the cypress tree in the courtyard, sometimes the oak tree in the garden, sometimes the juniper tree. I guess if you're a botanist, you know that one of those three is correct. But we use all three kinds to talk about that particular koan. And Zhaozhou was famous for his pithy and direct answers to people. It's said about Zhaozhou, Mike talked about Zhaozhou yesterday, his history, his long life, and especially long period of being a student of the way before he even began teaching. It was said that his lips gave off light. Every time somebody asked him a question, he said exactly the thing that was right for the person who had asked. We've been talking about one way to get into these koans is to understand that all these people who populate the koans are no other than ourselves. So we have to be Zhaozhou. We have to see and feel and sense what Zhaozhou was feeling and sensing and understanding when he would give these amazing light-filled answers. The cypress tree in the garden as the response to why did Bodhidharma come from the West? The one word mu, which means not or non or nothing, in response to does it, even a dog have the Buddha nature? And here comes his student, whose name is Yan Yang. And Yan Yang was an interesting person. We know almost nothing about him, which, again, in terms of the history of Zen, means that he probably really existed. It's this wonderful thing that if there's more details about them, they're probably made up. But around this guy, we don't know anything except that he was Zhaozhou's student, that he himself, after receiving transmission, after his study and practice with his teacher Zhaozhou, became a teacher himself. He was quite respected as almost a saint in the tradition because he made friends with all kinds of animals who would come and eat out of his hands, especially tigers and snakes. So he was a friend to tigers. Dangerous animals would come to him while he was sitting in zazen, and he would have some food for them, and they would eat out of his hands, and snakes would slither up and get some yummy food from the venerable Yan Yang. But this is a story about when Yan Yang was a student of the way, before he became a teacher, before he consorted with snakes and tigers. Or maybe he'd been doing that all along. I don't know. As I say, we don't know much about him. So he asks a question that's a question that recurs throughout koans, and it recurs in the Doksan room very often, even in this modern day, because of a fundamental misunderstanding about what practice is. And we've been talking about this, that this Zen practice is not about emptying your mind. It's not about becoming a blank. It's not knowing in the sense of blankness, as Zhaozhou's teacher, Nanchuan, told him in that dialogue that Mike read to us the other night, or the other day. And so this misunderstanding that we're supposed to be sitting here emptying ourselves. Instead, we're sitting here learning how to be human beings fully, how to embrace the Buddha nature as exemplified by us. We do, of course, refine and we grow in wisdom and in compassion through the years, through the decades of our lives. But we have our fundamental nature that we had when we popped out of the womb, whatever that might be. And it gets refined over the years and it gets distorted. And when we're sitting on the cushion, we can see all kinds of ways that those distortions happened. And so our inner light, our Buddha nature, our fundamental original heart comes forward as light, as presence, as a compassion beyond helpfulness, and a wisdom that cuts through all kinds of delusion. So this clarity and kindness and settledness is our birthright. We don't have to make it happen. It arises when we stop struggling against ourselves. So Yan Yang is one of those students at this point in his life when he thinks he has transcended something and he thinks that not a single thing arises. So he's asking the question, when not a single thing is brought, then what? So there's a little bit of arrogance and bragging in this. You know, I have achieved the emptiness of all things. I am not bringing anything. And Zhaozhou, his lips emitting light, says, well then, put it down. What a great answer. In another translation, it says, drop it. I think of a puppy coming up to the teacher saying, look what I've got for you. It's nothing. And the teacher says, drop it. Drop this nothing that you're bringing to me. Drop this fake sense that you have achieved something. Put it down. Put it down. There's a wonderful story. I've talked about it in other Dharma talks in the past, that a friend of mine who used to travel in India quite a bit told me. She said that the story goes that a man got on a train in India, a very, very crowded train, and he had a big trunk on his head. And he was carefully balancing the trunk on top of his head. And the conductor came by and collected his money, which was a little bit difficult to do because he had to hold this trunk on top of his head. And the conductor politely said to him, why are you carrying your trunk on your head? And the passenger said, if I don't do that, I might lose it. I have to keep it here. And I want it to get to my destination. And the conductor said, sir, if you put it down on the floor, the train will carry it for you. So it's a little bit like that, isn't it? We're holding tight to I had this insight and I understand things and I've done a lot of koans, or we hold tight to, I'm an idiot, or I just keep messing up, or oh, do, there I go again, in the words of the great sage Homer Simpson. This is this tendency that all of us have to clutch onto something, even nothing. Yes. So Yan Yang shows his great spirit, his great persistence, by keeping going. He doesn't quite get it. You know, I'm showing you, I'm empty. I'm a great master of the way. I don't have any thoughts arising. I'm really, you know, please affirm how great I am. He says, if I don't bring a single thing, then what should I put down? There's also, I think, a little bit of, maybe a lot of great sincerity in this response. He's confused and he's not afraid to admit it. What do I put down? I don't get it. And Zhaozhou says, well then, carry it away with you. Which is not the kind of answer we might expect these days, where somebody might say, as I'm saying in this Dharma talk blabbing on, watch out for that dangerous place where we think we've achieved something, especially if we think we've achieved nothing. Put it down, and if you can't put it down, then take it with you. What a lovely instruction. One of the things that that Hungjer points out in his verse, which is a little bit hard to understand, so I'm going to read it again, just because it has a lot of allusions to Chinese history and folklore and customs. But one of the things he's pointing out is how we get fooled so easily. We think we're playing a game, and we get distracted by the game. We think that Zen is this thing that we can learn how to do. And we have to be disabused of that notion over and over and over again. This is not a game. It's the most serious thing that any human being can do, in my humble opinion. It's an amazing practice for, as I said earlier, learning how to be human. Learning to be a human who is born and lives and dies, or, as we touched into yesterday, is born and dies every moment. The old self struggles. We keep it on top of our head because we're afraid that life won't take it with us. All of your ideas and your knowledge, none of it will disappear. Well, actually, that's not true. The things that are not grounded in the most basic reality, they will disappear. But this basic reality doesn't disappear. And our last out-breath is as important as every other out-breath for our whole life. And our first in-breath, when we come out of the womb screaming and crying, is repeated endlessly. It's not a game. One of the games that's played often in Japan is the game of Go, which is sometimes called Japanese chess, but it's a very different game than chess. Although it has some similarities, it's a battle between two armies, and there's taking and killing and, you know, knocking over and trying to occupy space and land. So in that way, there's a lot of similarities, and there's ways to learn how to play chess and Go, where you can get really, really good at it by understanding how the board works, how pieces move, how things happen. Sometimes the game of Go or the game of chess are considered models for how to live a human life. And Hongzhi is referring to the game of Go in this poem. Maybe I'll read it once, tell you another story, and then read it again so you'll understand another line. So Hongzhi says, not prepared for meticulous action, he loses to the first to move. Realizing himself the coarseness of his mind, he's embarrassed at bumping his head. When the game is ended, the axe handle's rotted at his side. Clean and purify the ordinary bones to play with the immortals. Wan Sang comments on this poem by talking about the game of Go, he says that one of the instructions of an old Go master is, the other doesn't dare advance, you don't dare advance. Only this not daring to advance is why there's no contest. Only if there's no contest do you enter into non-dying and non-birth. Go is the method of contending over the lead. If you win, then you win an aggressive move. If you lose, you lose a confrontation. And then Wan Sang goes on to say, before you put down your piece, Zhao Zhou already sees several moves ahead. Yan Yang only flies around and leaps right over. Moreover, occupying how many columns? He doesn't realize what's going on. So Yan Yang is still playing a game. He's still trying to win and probably would be unhappy if he loses. And yet we can imagine, because later he became a great teacher, at least we know he was a great teacher because he had great students. As I said, we don't know much about him, but his line did continue for a while. And he is sort of bested, that's not the right word, he is shown another way, just like the man on the train by his teacher Zhao Zhou. What if this was serious? And I love Zhao Zhou's compassion here, because he's not trying to talk him out of anything. He's saying, well, if you have this mistaken notion, keep it with you. I think that's a very skillful way to teach. Keep it with you until it by itself dissolves into wisdom and compassion. We don't have to make anything happen. But in our long hours of sitting practice, what we're asked to do again and again is to see the arising of whatever arises. As Linji said in the text we've been chanting quite a bit, if it arises, don't hold on to it, and if it doesn't arise, don't make it arise. Whatever's here is here. So if some mistaken notion of emptiness arises, we want to look at it carefully, see our attachment to it, notice what happens as we clutch onto these things, and then we show honestly how we're practicing to a teacher, and then the teacher gets to say, not that, or how about this? So the reference to the axe handles rotted at his side, that's the line that I wanted to just look into a bit more deeply. The axe handles rotted at his side comes from a Chinese fairy tale about a man who went to chop wood on a mountain. And he went into a cave because he heard some talking and laughing in the cave. And there were four young boys sitting there playing Go. And he sat down and they invited him to play with him. And he played, and at one point one of the boys gave him something to eat, like a date, a little bit of dried fruit. And he ate it, and it was very, very delicious and satisfying. And he found that he had lots of energy to keep going in the game. And then the boys said, the game's over. They bowed to him and left the cave. And he looked down at himself, and the axe that he'd been chopping wood with, the handle had completely rotted away, and all his clothes had turned to rags. Those of you who know the American story, Rip Van Winkle, might hear some similarities, except in that, because it was early American history, it was bowling. He bowled with these mysterious people in the mountains. But this guy was playing Go. So what does it mean that this man in the story is being compared to Yan Yang? Well, of course, we can get so caught up in our game, the game of trying to figure it all out, of trying to be a good boy or a good girl, of trying to improve ourselves, of trying to replace our own body and head with someone else's body and head, that we can miss our whole life. And as life goes on, hopefully the Dharma touches our hearts at some point and we wake up. None of those years of playing games are wasted. And yet, the moment of seeing what we've been doing, all of the rationales and schemes that we've created to improve our lives, to see that we've been holding on to them for our endless eons of birth and death and breathing in and breathing out, and then to recognize the importance of this great way and to begin again with great freshness, as if the next breath were the only breath we'd ever breathed and the out-breath after that was the end of everything. Continuous birth and death, Dogen talks about. Continuous engagement. If you think you've achieved something, put it down. And if you can't put it down, then carry it with you until it drops away by itself. Venerable Yan Yang asked Zhao Zhou, when not a single thing is brought, then what? Zhao Zhou said, put it down. Yan Yang said, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? Zhao Zhou said, then carry it out. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue now. Reminder that this is being recorded, so if you would like your comment or question or observation not recorded, just let us know. We'll turn the recorder off. Thank you.
was actually just going to ask if you would reread the opening, the very first sentence of the introduction about reflections.
Yeah.
I liked it, and it went by very fast.
It did. I didn't comment on it. Sometimes when we do choose comments for Sashin, we do the same one over and over, over many days, because there's so much richness in it. Yeah. So this is one son. He says, playing with reflections, struggling for the form, you don't recognize that the form is the source of the reflection. And there's another translation of this, playing with shadows, struggling for the form, you don't recognize that the form is the source of the shadow. So these shadows, you know, think about that guy in the cave playing games for decades and decades. Think of all of us playing games and the actual thing itself, right, the form. Let me read it again. Playing with reflections, struggling for the form, you don't recognize that the form is the source of the reflection. Yeah.
It reminds me of early in the Dhammapada, I think it says something like, you know, all that we are is a result of what we've thought, and with our thoughts we make the world. And, you know, that's to me very profound, right? But this, it's also like, I think the Zen version of it might be what we read this morning, that everything we meet is ourselves. Or as several times has been said, you know, the world reflects back very exactly.
Oh, can you speak up a little bit?
That the world reflects back very exactly whatever we're doing.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And when you don't understand that that's what's going on, it creates all kinds of confusion. You think you're dealing with some unpredictable other. Which you are in a certain way. But not in the way you think.
Yeah, right. The unpredictable other is right here.
It's right. Right. Yeah.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful column.
Yeah, very rich column. Yeah, Tim.
The train will carry it for you. Yeah, I took a road trip with my cousin recently, and we were both talking about these surprising coincidences and grace and like the way you have the same thought as another person or you see a word on a tea bag or something that, you know, it just seems like an unusual coincidence. And I was kind of thinking, like, the thoughts they're not my thoughts or his thoughts, they're in the environment, and we just happen to be the ones there to get the thoughts, and somehow the train carrying the bag made me think of that, like, yeah, it could, the train, I am the bag.
Right.
And yeah, and I'm the train.
Yeah.
And I'm not the, yeah, it brought it to mind somehow. I'm not expressing it very
well. No, thank you.
Well, and it reminds me of the Buddhist notion that thinking is just another sense, like smelling and hearing. Mm-hmm. You know, we think, oh, these are my thoughts, but this idea that maybe the mind just picks up what's in the environment, right? So this identification of, well, there's me and my bag and there's a train and I have to hold it together. This bigger self of the whole world, you know, the whole world is your Dharma body, the Dharma body of the self. And all of this is pointing toward overcoming this basic delusion of separation, right? It really appears that there's me and there's the world. There are two classes of things, and it's quite clear from the sense world. But when we really enter in, we see, oh, it's not separate.
Just want to add,
sorry,
what you're saying. I find that, you know, the not separate is the moment you put language into it.
Right.
It's real. That's why we have koans. I mean, because they're written in the languages that supersede our ability to separate things. Because we have to separate things to follow grammatic rules. But life isn't a grammatic rule.
Yeah. Right, life isn't a grammatic rule. And yet, we do have, you know, it's one of the ironies of Zen and Taoism that there's all this language about words, you know, but then there's tons of words. Yeah, because they're tools. I think of them as tools, but they're not the thing itself. Unless sometimes they are the thing itself. There are some koans where the words themselves are the important point. So, that's right. And Susan?
This one really touched me today in so many ways. Probably because I turned 70 this month, and I've been not really thinking, but what has been arising for me was, what if I forgot to live my life?
Yeah.
And then I put language to it, and I list a resume. Yeah. I didn't forget to live my life. And yet there's this sense of that reflection language, you know, that my life is the resource, is the source of that reflection. And I didn't forget to live it. So I don't know what to say about that, that really touched where my being has been for a couple of months now. I said, what if I forgot to live my life?
Our lives don't forget to live us.
Yeah.
There is this effortless functioning. It's like also in the preface, it's, you know, riding an ox to find an ox. Mm-hmm. Right? We think, oh, I might have missed my ox. Where is my ox? And all the while, this life living itself, the self-selfing itself, perfectly at ease.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I found it. First, the koan was confusing me. I didn't get it. And then you started to explain it. But then it all kind of dropped into place when you mentioned that they were referencing go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have these odd aspirations that one day I'm going to teach myself how to play. And it's funny because there's only one rule. And because of that, it's extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can read books on strategy and they give you some idea, but really the only way to learn is to play it or to examine other games that were played and try and put yourself in this one of the seats. And sometimes you continue the game to see what would I have done. So it's like, you know, studying koan sort of. And also I've watched a couple of documentaries because I'm this kind of nerd on trying to make a computer program that would be, you know, that would play Go at the level of a master. And they said it's so much harder because in chess, you know, American or Western chess, you can brute force it. You can just go through all the possible permutations. But the number of possible chess games is minuscule compared to the number of possible Go games just because of the number of moves you can make at any given time. Every space that's open on the board is a possible new move, not, you know, these, you know, 20 things you can do at any given time. So part of the difficulty of writing a computer program is it's not just, well, what can I do? What makes sense to do next? It's what are the patterns on the board? And it's the, not the thinking, but the observing of what's there and what's not there. Again, it's, I laugh going, well, one day I'll teach myself, but it's not like one day I'm going to learn how to play, it's continually just by playing and, you know, if I ever have time, you know, at some point I'm like, okay, well, I can kind of get it, but there's that never really getting good at it, kind of like probably never becoming, you know, a true Zen master, you know, always a student. you know, in my martial arts, we say, you know, sometimes a teacher, always a student.
Yes.
But it's the same with all this, and you just kind of, I thought the parallel was really neat.
Well, and another parallel in Go is, David and I taught ourselves to play 35 years ago. And we would just sit down and set, you know, first you just set up a small Go board and then you get it bigger and bigger. So this thing is you put a piece down or you move a piece, the whole board changes with the one move. It's very much like life. And so, you know, Go masters they're like Zen masters in that they see the permutations very quickly, but we would the move and then go, oh my God, and we would get so anxious. Do you remember that? We would like get almost have anxiety attacks, like, oh. And so we've after a year I think we gave up playing because it was too upsetting. It was just like, I can't, we were just starting out in Zen, we didn't know anything.
And not that there was any competitive.
No, we're pretty good. That hasn't changed. But that feeling of this is how life actually is. So the other night Mike gave a talk about karma, that there's an infinite number of causes and conditions that cause this moment, and there is no way to know. You can't take any amount and go, oh, it's because of this. You know, I got a cold because I was in a room with a it's just like there's a vast number of reasons why anything happens. And Go reflects that. You know, you put it down and then the whole board changes. So you get up in the morning and we think, oh, you know, it's 6 o'clock or it's 4 o'clock or it's 10 o'clock, whatever. Now I know stuff. This knowing things, as Zhao Zhou's teacher said, is a delusion. Right? So it's a wonderful game for that. But manage your competitiveness and anxiety, I would say, if you want to learn how to play Go.
Just to add to that, karma. I think it was Carl Sagan, maybe, who said, or some astronomer said, if you really want to bake an apple pie from scratch, you have to start from the Big Bang.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, and we also used to have a game that we played, we still play it, you know, oh, if only I hadn't said or done this thing. And then you go back to, well, but then if only I hadn't done the thing before that, and the thing before that, and all the way to the Big Bang.
Yeah. Everything we're talking about is really helping me. Yesterday, I was in the midst of a lot of new experiences. I started getting texts from one of my closest friends who couldn't stop crying because she was watching the news about Australia and the devastation. And I was like, when I think of, I wasn't crying about it. I was paying attention to a lot of other things. And so I have been crying. I had cried. I will cry. I am crying almost. And this analogy, all of this that we're talking about, that you do one thing and it changes everything, and the train. I knew that I had to say something. It wasn't going to be a phone call. It was going to be texting, and I knew that's what it was going to be. And this person is one of the most sincere people I've ever met. And I just like, it's almost like my words and her words and my words kind of became the train, kind of, or became like, and this morning, this was like for a long time, and this morning there was a good morning. I arrived to this day. I made it to this day. I didn't think I would make it to this day. And I don't know what I would have done without those words, but I did not know. I just knew my own sadness. Mm-hmm. And I knew that
every koala isn't going to die. A lot of them died, but I know that I've read they're saving them. And just saying that's not true, that every koala isn't going to die. Yeah. And being horrified at the same time and being terrified and sharing in the terrifyingness, it was like just we were carrying each other through it.
Yeah.
And yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, and I really appreciate you talking that there is a way that we can enter into what is here in the moment. And we don't enter in from the place of knowing. Because if we know, we have already separated. We already have the story. But entering in great pain through words or through whatever, then it is the train. It is the stream of the Dharma, of life, of this great mystery that carries us. And so we cry and we laugh and we have perspective and we lose perspective. And we wake up in the morning and we say, oh my goodness, here I am. What a miracle.
Thank you. Esther, did you have it?
Yeah, but I'm having some self-judgments around what I wanted to say. But I'll come forward anyways. So, I have a question around listening to koans and context about koans and words and a complexity from a place of not doing anything. Of not doing it.
Yeah, so what's your question?
So my question is because I know that I get tangled up in the conceptual world and trying to do something with it, I suppose. And then what happens is I feel overwhelmed. And then I kind of withdraw a little bit. So the maybe the receiving, the being with all of that, what is the practice?
Just what you said. So you get, as I recall, you get all tangled up. The first step is you get all tangled up, right? Mm-hmm. And then you get what happens next?
Then I get overwhelmed.
Overwhelmed, oh, right? Tangled up, overwhelmed,
yeah.
And then you withdraw. So that's your practice. That's great. That's, you know, it feels sucky. but it is, in fact, like everything in Zen, a mirror for how your heart-mind works. And there's nothing wrong with it. And of course, it reminds me of the dialogue completely. You know, I could say to you, put it down. But you can't, if you're a real sincere student, you go, but I get confused and I get lost, I get tangled up and I withdraw. Then I can say, the real teaching in this koan, carry it with you. Oh, this is what I get to work with. This is like Joanne's sadness. When you said, all I know is my sadness. It's not that I don't want you to be confused forever, I don't want you to be sad forever. But that's what arises. Precious life arising in the form of sadness, confusion, tangled, withdrawn. And you get to be with it in good company.
And there's something about the not doing anything about it, really. You know, just sort of having this experience and not having to...
Not interfering.
Right. The train carry.
Right.
And even appreciating it. I mean, I think that's what this is your great resource, and you have an abundance of it, right?
It's very cognitive.
Great, that's great. That's wonderful.
Go ahead.
Good work.
I had a student come to me one time and said, my practice is I don't have a practice. I said, that's great.
I would have said, are you bragging?
Put it down.
Put it down.
I don't
carry it with you.
But it is so unbelievable that what we have is the resource. Because it appears so clearly as this is the problem I came to Zen for, precisely. And that this staying that Melissa talked about, this possibility of doing nothing, of realizing, oh, this is the train, this is life, this is the chi mind of Bodhidharma.
So I'm actually, to end this Dharma dialogue, I'm very moved to read you all something. Let you in on the process of giving a Dharma talk. You've heard how rich the koan is. I could have gone in at least six conscious directions, and one of them was closer to what you're experiencing. I didn't go there. But it's about this inner battle that we're always fighting our own life. You know, I shouldn't be sad or I shouldn't be confused. That doesn't match my idea of myself. And it actually goes back to Will quoting the Dhammapada. You know, that I almost went in that direction to quote the Dhammapada about that very thing. You know, that we divide ourselves against ourselves. So I never do this, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to read a little section from the talk that didn't happen. And this is by Bankei, who, it's a comment on Jerry Shishinwick comments on the koan by quoting this teacher. When did Bankei live? I don't know, sometime medieval Japan, maybe 16th, in the 16th century or something like that. And this is what Bankei says. You people, you try to stop your thoughts of clinging and craving from arising, and then by stopping them, you divide one mind into two. The original clinging thoughts that you were able to stop may have come to an end. No, this does happen, right? But the subsequent thoughts concerned with your stopping them won't ever cease. This is great. And how many, 500 years ago. Well, you might wonder, what can I do to stop them? Just let them come. Don't develop them any further. Don't attach to them. Without concerning yourself about whether to stop your rising thoughts or not to stop them, just don't bother with them. Just don't bother with them. And then there's nothing else they can do but vanish. You can't have an argument with a fence when there's no one there to fight with. Things can't help but simply come to an end of themselves. So we come to the end of our Dharma dialogue, and let's just sit for a few moments while we let it all sink in.